This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
So it's really a pleasure to welcome back to PNP Daniel Levitin. As some of you may recall, he was here for his three previous books, each of which became a bestseller, and we have very high hopes for his latest, which is just out this week. This is a world premiere here. His latest book's called A Field Guide to Lies. Dan, of course, is a distinguished neuroscientist and expert on cognitive science. And what he's offering in his new book are some very helpful ways to sift through the growing barrage of information facing us day in and day out. How to tell fact from fiction, how to make sense of statistics, how to think critically about all the words and numbers coming at us nonstop. And these are some of the challenges that Dan addresses. And what better time to be advised on this during this political season? You guys know where I'm going. During this political season, as we try to figure out what's truthful about the many things being said by and about the candidates. I don't know about many of you, but when I read, say, the Washington Post these days, one of the first columns I look at is the fact checker. Truth-squatting efforts like that have become essential for navigating the news, and Dan has provided just such a useful set of tools in his new book. A review in Publishers Weekly called the book, quote, a valuable primer on critical thinking that convincingly illustrates the prevalence of misinformation in everyday life. And Kirkus recommended the book for, quote, anyone willing to evaluate claims and get to the truth of the matter. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Daniel Levitin.
Oh, well, what a great turnout. Thank you all for coming. And I'm just delighted to be here. The book came out yesterday. This is my first event. I'm really excited to launch the book here in Washington, D.C., to launch it at Politics and Prose, one of the great independent bookstores in this country. And, you know, how many of you were here at my talk last year about the organized mind? Well, if you'll indulge me to just repeat myself for a moment, I think one of the great things about bookstores that some people forget is that they are community spaces where we can come together and exchange ideas. As you're walking across the floor to buy the book you think you wanted, you're likely to be sidetracked by a book you didn't even know existed that is even more exciting than the one you came in for. And as efficient as online shopping is, it doesn't really lead to that kind of serendipity and that kind of a sense of community, although online communities have popped up and, you know, people try to make recommendations. But I think there is really something to be said for a community bookstore, and the surprise that can result from spending time in one. So thank you very much for your efforts at providing such a space. A round of applause. Well, I'd like to start my talk with a quote. You'll forgive me for using notes, I hope. This is my first talk, and I'm just learning as I go. It ain't what you know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. How many of you are familiar with this Mark Twain quote? So it's out there, right? What does it mean? Well, I think it means that if you know something for sure, you're likely to move kind of headstrong with a convincing conviction and resolve into some enterprise. You don't plan for the possibility that you're wrong. If you know that you don't know something, you have a little bit more trepidation. You're a little bit more cautious. Those can be good qualities. And I think it's certainly true that in corporate boardrooms and in government offices, in the White House, in Congress, in the schoolyard, in hospitals and doctors' offices, a lot of trouble comes from people being absolutely certain they know something and being wrong. And that's the launch point for my book. And it comes from some personal experience, which is that part of my job as a professor is to train PhD students. And people who haven't been through a PhD program ask me what that involves. I'm often at a cocktail party or at some kind of a social gathering, and people say, what is it you actually do for a living? And what do you do over the summer? Don't you have a whole summer off? And I say, well, no, it doesn't really work that way. I've got doctoral students, and I've got to meet with them all the time. And, you know, they really get their work done during the summer because they're not distracted by taking classes. And what does that mean that you teach doctoral students? I say, well, when they come in, they think they know everything because, you know, in order to end up in graduate school, they had to be the very best students in elementary school and the very best students in their class in high school. In order to get into a good college, they had to be at the top of their class in college in order to get into graduate school. And boy, they really think that they are hot stuff and that I've got nothing to teach them and that there's nothing to learn. And I spend 4 years, sometimes five or six, trying to teach them that they don't know as much as they think they know. That is my job. My job is not teaching so much as unteaching, or, you know, not so much trying to get them to learn but to unlearn. And it's maybe half true that the day that a doctoral student comes to my office and knocks on the door and says, you know, I really don't know a thing about what it is you want me to learn. That's the day I say, congratulations, you're ready to get your degree. Because it's that kind of humility and openness that means they're really ready to become lifelong learners and to start this enterprise of creating knowledge, which is what scholarship is all about. Until they're open-minded enough to realize they don't know much, they're really not of any use, because if they know everything, then there's nothing for them to learn, right? So a lot of that involves critical thinking, and that's what this book is about. I started writing the book in 2001. I've been working on it a long time, and I've been teaching courses on critical thinking with some great students who have helped me a lot by providing examples. And one of the examples of a failure to heed the Mark Twain's advice, a failure to realize that what you don't know for sure will get you into trouble, or what you know for sure that isn't so will get you into trouble, is unfortunately the story of Steve Jobs. So Steve Jobs, as you know, died of pancreatic cancer. And the particular circumstance was that when it was diagnosed, he decided that he didn't trust Western medicine. He was going to seek some sort of alternative woo-woo Northern California treatment that involved a change in his diet. And by the time he realized that the diet wasn't curing the cancer, it was too late for medicine to help him. So this was a case of somebody knowing for sure, and a smart person, and by all accounts a rational person, knowing for sure something that wasn't so, knowing that alternative medicine was going to fix the problem. So you can see in a very real sense that the pitfalls of holding false beliefs can really get you into trouble. As I say, in the boardroom, in Congress, in the White House, in your own personal life, and in medical decisions. And what this requires is a kind of attitude towards the world that information's going to change, that you might know something for now and new information may come in and you might need to change your mind as that new information comes in. In science, we have a kind of fancy name for this. It's called Bayesian reasoning. And if you haven't heard of it, don't worry about it. It's just a bunch of people trying to be fancy. All it really means is Bayesian reasoning is nothing more exotic than allowing new information to modify the beliefs that you already held, to take the new information into account and possibly change your mind if the new information warrants it. This kind of attitude requires doing what the philosopher Alan Watts wrote about in his book, The Wisdom of Insecurity. Embrace the fact that you're not going to know for sure and just trust the process that you know, new information will come in and you'll evaluate it. First, they told us you had to eat a lot of carbs, and then they said carbs were bad, and then fish was good, and then it had mercury, and then fish is good again, but it's not good if you have prostate cancer. And I mean, you know, yeah, that's the way science works. It's a self-correcting process, and it can drive you crazy, but you got to adopt the new information as it comes in. And this kind of inquisitiveness, I can tell you as a neuroscientist, is innate. We're wired up to be an inquisitive species, but unfortunately, many of us have it beaten out of us by impatient teachers and impatient parents. I mean, think about a four-year-old, right? They're always inquisitive. They're always asking why. You have to go to bed at 8 o'clock. Why? Because that's your bedtime. Why? Because you need to have a good night's sleep. Why? Because if you don't, you're not going to be rested. Why? You know, it goes on and on and on. And, you know, that kind of inquisitiveness is what it takes to stay an informed member of society and to stay up on current events and modify your opinion. So the first piece of advice I have is to think like a four-year-old. Keep asking how and why and be relentless about it. You don't have to be mean-spirited about it, but, you know, if somebody says something, ask them, I'm not doubting you, but how do you know that? What's your data? What's your evidence? What caused you to believe that? I'd like to look into it, too. You don't have to be confrontational like some of the radio pundits are. It can be done in a respectful way. And I'd like to talk about some of the pitfalls that we encounter in trying to solve these what and why and how questions, trying to be critical thinkers. One of them has to do – one of my favorite examples of how critical thinking requires a system. And by the way, the system that I'm proposing in the book, I don't think it's any more difficult than a 12-year-old could handle. And I'm not talking about doing heavy math or, you know, having to learn a bunch of special things you don't already know. I'm talking about things you can do in a couple hours that are commonsensical. So first thing is to recognize that averages actually are useful, but they're a distortion of reality. And we don't think of them that way. And, of course, Nate Silver has made himself famous by averaging polls and such. But averages are really tricky. They're tricky because they're distortions. They're taking a whole bunch of data, sometimes millions of data points, and collapsing them into a single number. So you can imagine how that might cause some problems. And I don't want to pick on one particular source, but I just read in a study by the Pew Research Center, who are pretty good most of the time, that the Americans read an average of 12 books per year. Now, that's the mean, they say. Now, they don't tell us any more about it. They tell us a little more, which I'll get to in a second, but they don't tell us much more. So what does it mean for the average to be 12 books a year? It could be there's a whole bunch of people reading 24 books a year and a whole bunch of people reading zero books a year. And then the average would be 12. But the mean would be 12. That's one of three different kinds of averages. So the average in this case is a number that doesn't actually represent anybody at all. So how does that summarize the data in an accurate way? It doesn't. It's a distortion. Now, I could add to that story, suppose there's a whole bunch of people who read 24 books a year, a whole bunch of people who read none, and one person who reads 12. There's another kind of average called the median, and that's the number, as most of you know, where half the people are above that number and half the people are below. So here I could tell you the median is 12, which is in fact what Pew reported, but in my made-up example, the median could be 12, and that still doesn't tell you very much about the distribution. In Pew's case, they're reporting a median of 4. So half the people read more than 4, half the people read less, which really suggests that there's a whole bunch of people reading 0 or close to 0. But Pew does a terrible disservice to us by reporting that the median is the typical value. Well, that's not usually true. Typical value is what we call the mode. That's the value you see most often. In order for the median to be the typical value, the mode would have to be 4. That is, the majority of people or the value you find most often is 4. And that just seems unlikely. So you have to be careful about averages and their use and misuse. And if somebody just uses the word average and they don't say mean, median, or mode, you don't know a thing about what they're saying. I don't want to dwell on this. It's in the book, and I don't want to get too bogged down in the technical. It's just an alert that averages are distortions. Just as another example, suppose I tell you, and I don't want to belabor this, but suppose I tell you there's a room over there, and the mean, so I'm specifying the kind of average, the mean net worth in that room is about $5 billion per person. Now, if you're in an investment banker or you work for the IRS, you might want to go in that room and talk to those people. Or if you're a salesman of Teslas or something. But what if I tell you that now that, yes, even though there are 10 people in the room and the mean net worth is $5 billion apiece, but the room is Mark Zuckerberg and 9 indigent people, right? I mean, the mean hasn't really told you anything useful. So I would just say be cautious and be wary. So next time you encounter an average, ask yourself, are they telling me what kind of average it is, and are they giving me any clue about what the distribution looks like? You know, are they helping me to understand what's really behind that single number? Another thing that we find a lot of is distortions based not exclusively on the numbers, but on words. People use words in a vague way, and if people are being vague with language, either they don't know any better or they're trying to put something over on you. And this has resulted in some interesting lawsuits. So how many of you remember the claim, 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate for their patients? You remember this? Well, Colgate's ad agency was sued and by a competitor who won the case because what do you think when you hear that 4 out of 5 dentists recommend Colgate? That they're exclusively recommending Colgate, right? That's the one they like. But in fact, the way the study was conducted is the dentist could list any number of toothpastes they wanted to. They weren't limited to one. So 4 out of 5 of them did recommend Colgate, but they also recommended Crest and Aim and Aquafresh and you know, Arm & Hammer and a whole bunch of others. So it wasn't a lie. It was just misleading, right? So if somebody's vague, if you know, the next time you read 4 out of 5 doctors recommend, or 4 out of 5 of anybody is recommending, ask yourself, well, what does that really mean? What question were they asked? And if that information isn't revealed to you, if the source isn't being above board about the details, it may be they have something to hide, or maybe they just are hoping you won't ask, or maybe it's innocuous and they just forgot to tell you. I'd also like to point out that when you encounter numbers and statistics, I think many of us hold this bias that numbers don't lie. Statistics don't lie. I mean, there's something about the cold, hard precision of a number. But I guess it's true. Numbers don't lie, but people sure can lie with numbers. Statistics are... I almost thought of calling the book Statistics Are People Too. But that's not really true. That would be a lie. Statistics aren't people too, but statistics are collected by people. They're collected by some well-meaning people who do a very good job. They're collected by well-meaning people who lack the training, who get thrust into a position to collect numbers, but they don't really know what they're doing. And they're collected by evil, lying weasels who are really trying to distort things. And we see this all the time in surveys where, a question will be asked and the numbers will be collected. But the question is asked of a certain cohort of people that have a certain view ahead of time. They don't tell you that. If I want to know what Americans think about something, I can't just stand in front of a horse racing track and take people as they exit. Not that there's anything wrong with horse racing tracks, but the kind of people who are there might not be typical of the country as a whole. And so a bias has crept in. I could say to somebody, do you think that Hillary Clinton has ever in her lifetime said something that wasn't true either intentionally or unintentionally, including white lies like, oh, yes, Aunt Tilly, I think your hat looks very nice. Do you think Hillary Clinton ever did that even once in her life or not? And so I can then take the result. You're probably 90%. I'm guessing. I'm making this up. Maybe 90% of people would say, yes, she probably has, you know, told a lie at least once. But then you can say 90% of Americans say Hillary Clinton is a liar, right? And that, well, yeah, they do. But, you know, I mean, there's devils in the details. And I'm not trying to be partisan here. I'm very completely apolitical in the book. Like anybody else, I have a preferred candidate. I try to keep an open mind and realize that some new information may emerge that my candidate is not the one I want to support and that the other candidate is better. But I try to keep all of that out of the book and out of my public life because, you know, I'm trying to be impartial. So for that matter, I mean, somebody could say the same thing. I could have used Donald Trump in the example. Do you think he ever told one lie at least once? So you have to be careful the way people spin the words around things. Another thing I advise is that people do plausibility checks. And this is nothing more than just asking whether the claim makes any sense. And maybe you have to do a quick check to find out. How many of you people know the within an order, you know, within a rough approximation, how many people think they know the population of the world? So what would you say it is? 9 billion. Does that seem like it's let's set up a confidence interval somewhere between 7 and 11 billion. How many people think that it's probably between 7 and 11 billion? How many people think it's not? Okay, what do you think?
Six.
6 billion. Okay, reasonable. Anybody else? 6.8. I'm sorry. What did you say? Yeah. Oh, I missed it. I missed a funny remark. Wouldn't be the first time. So I don't actually know. I haven't looked it up in a while. The last time I looked, it was 7 billion. 7.4. Thank you. Now, right, you can Google it. It's and then there's a clock that keeps track, and it's not actually counting the number of babies that are born and other people that are dying, but it's based on some good statistics. 7 billion, 7.5 billion. Now, I haven't paid much attention to it. It's not one of my preoccupations. I suppose it could have slipped up to 8 billion without me noticing since the last time. And I suppose, you know, there could have been an epidemic that wiped out a bunch of people or a genocide. It could have slipped down to 6.5. But I mean, I have a pretty good idea of what the range is. So when the person who cuts my hair said, "I heard that there are 11 billion people in the world that don't have internet," I realized, well, that's not plausible because there aren't 11 billion people in the world, right? So, I mean, you can do that kind of thing. But you hear this kind of stuff all the time. Suppose you're working for a company and an employee claims they spent $40,000 in gas the last month and they're looking for a reimbursement. So, you know, well, I don't know if that's plausible or not. I never thought about it, but you can work through it. You can just make some simple assumptions, like let's say there are 744 hours in a month, and you know, for the sake of argument, let's assume the employee is driving all the time and is taking speed and not taking naps or sharing with another driver or something. So you got 744 hours you could be driving. Let's call it 700 just for a round number because you got to stop and refuel and have coffee and stuff. And let's assume that our employee is speeding and has somehow managed to drive 700 hours in a row without being detected going 80 miles an hour, just to give the benefit of the doubt to the claim. And let's assume that they got really bad mileage at 10 miles per gallon. Well, if you work through the numbers, 700 times 80 miles per hour, 700 hours, 80 miles per hour. Boy, I thought I wrote this down. I might have to do this in my head now. if you work it out, the numbers come out to about $24,000 in gas. So $40,000 is not plausible. Just, you can work that through just like I did. Plausibility checks are important because a lot of claims just, that's maybe the first thing you want to do because a lot of claims go out the window right away. Another thing to do is to look carefully at graphs. Does anybody here work for Fox News? Just curious. Anybody? No?
It's not a Fox News crowd.
No, no. I love Fox News because they've kept me in business for a while. And I don't mean to pick on them, but one of my favorite examples from Fox News that I kind of start the book with is a picture that they broadcast during the last presidential election. 2010. For the 2012 presidential run,
I'm
on page 10. They show the 2012 projections, and they've got a pie chart. You're familiar with pie charts. It tells you what proportion of people are, you know, in favor of or are going in a certain direction. So here, 70% of the people they polled back Palin, 60% back Romney, and 63% back Huckabee. Now, you don't have to be a math whiz. You don't have to have taken calculus to know that those numbers add up to more than 100%. So the first rule of pie charts is the numbers have to add up to 100%, because once you've divided up the pie into 100%, there isn't any more pie. If you've got a second pie, I guess you could be dividing that up, but that doesn't make any sense. So you can imagine how something like this happened in the newsroom. They gave a poll, and people were allowed to say that they, like with the Crest Colgate thing, they're allowed to say they back more than one candidate. So if that's the case, report it that way in numbers, 63% back Huckabee, 60% back Palin. But don't make a pie chart, right? That just, you know, first thing, look at the chart. Ask yourself, does the chart make sense? Fox News, again, I really want to meet the graphic artist there and buy them a cupcake or something. They had this nice buy them a pie. Thank you. I'm going to use that tomorrow in Chicago. Even better, buy them two pies. Right, right. What a great crowd. It just keeps getting better. They published a graph. Graphs are important. The fact is, I can tell you, as a neuroscientist, I can tell you, we didn't evolve to make sense of tables of numbers. We're visual processors. And you look at a table of numbers, it's hard to discern a pattern. You look at a graph, and you can see the pattern. That's why we have them, and that's why they're important. But it's very easy for people, either because they're poorly educated or because they're super well-educated and they're trying to put something over on you, very easy for them to mess things up, as I say, unintentionally or intentionally. So picture a column graph, bar graph, where you're trying to show, Fox is trying to show what's going to happen when the Bush tax cuts expire. What's going to happen to the average tax rate, average again, but what's going to happen to the tax rate in this country? And so the fact is, when the Bush tax cuts were about to expire, it was going to change the tax rate for most Americans from 35% to 40%, where it was the top tax rate. I don't remember, but 35 to 40%. So if you were to graph this, the difference between a bar going up to 35% and a bar going up to 40%, you'd have a graph that looked like this. This is the 35, this is the 40. And there's about a 13% difference between the two, and you would visually see that. But what if you're trying to persuade the public that this is a bad thing, letting them expire? What if you're trying to sway public opinion? You don't want to show that graph. That's not going to make your point. So, well, instead of starting the graph at zero, why not start the graph at about 30%, which means you're looking at something that looks like this now. This is 30 to 34. This is 34 to 40. And now it looks like you're going to be paying three times as much tax if the tax cuts expire. Visually, it looks, you know, one bar is three times higher than the other. that's a classic kind of distortion, and we teach this in graduate schools. Journalists learn about it, lawyers learn about it, but most people don't. And I show it in the book. It's one of a few dozen kind of tricks that people can play on you, and from now on, none of you are ever going to fall for again. We talked about polls a moment ago. Some of the things to look out for with polls, be sure that they tell you the margin of error. If they don't tell you the margin of error, the poll is absolutely meaningless. The margin of error is how confident they are in their estimate. Usually the margin of error is 3%. It might be 5%. So if they tell you that there's a 70% chance that Trump would win if the election were held today, or that he'd win the popular vote or whatever they're telling you, if they say there's a 3% margin of error, that means that there's a 95% chance, that's what the margin of error represents, 95% chance that the true value falls between 70% plus or minus 3, between 67 and 73%. If they don't tell you the margin of error, you can say anything you want. I could tell you I'm the most popular person running for president with a margin of error of 100%. But if I don't say that last part, it's true. Also, you want to be sure that you're getting random sampling. We talked about this with the racetrack problem. Very, very difficult to do with polling. If you're polling based on landlines, land telephone lines, that skews towards older folks and misses out a lot of younger folks. If you use cell phones, it skews towards younger folks. If you use email, it skews towards people over 35, because increasingly people under 35 don't use email. And it also skews in terms of people who are willing to talk to a pollster, who may not be representative of the voting public at large. In this election in particular, I'm not a political scientist, so I don't know what the data are. But as a citizen, it strikes me that one thing that's going on is that there are a lot of single-issue voters. Voters who are really just focusing on a single issue, and they're voting for a candidate based on that candidate's stance on that single issue that they care about. You're going to take my gun away from me? I don't care what else you stand for. You're not getting my vote. You're going to raise my taxes? I don't care about anything else. You're not getting my vote. You're going to build a wall and get rid of immigration? I don't care what else you stand for. You're not getting my vote. Single issue. And that leads to a kind of closed-mindedness about the other issues. I'm not saying that it's right or wrong, but it can skew the polls because people may realize as it gets closer to voting day that there are more issues at stake, and maybe they're willing to bend a little bit on their one issue in order to get five or six other things they really want, right? Or maybe they're willing to acknowledge that, a president may not have enough power to push through the strong version of the agenda they're stumping for. So take polls with a grain of salt, and as you've seen, they fluctuate a lot. So tonight, tomorrow, when you're reading the news, when you're hearing the news, ask yourself, if it's a poll, who did the poll? Did they report the margin of error? Who responded to the poll? And if you could figure it out, what question were these people asked? Right? That's key. And, if you look at the Washington Post, the New York Times, CBS, they tend to give you links to where you can find this information. And PolitiFact helps here. And the Washington Post has a fact-checking site, which I recommend, because there are professional journalists who are keeping track of a lot of this stuff for us. I have a colleague at UC Berkeley where I teach in the business school. His name is Dr. Keltner. He has a new book out. It's called The Power Paradox. And in it, he reviews the evidence that powerlessness is one of the leading predictors of poor health outcomes in our society and of short life. So powerlessness is associated with these negative effects. And my view is, from the research I've done, is that critical thinking is an important ingredient in having power. People who lack critical thinking tend to be powerless in their lives. And the reason is they fall for scams. They make poor, non-evidence-based choices about where to live or who to get in a relationship with or what job to do or what kind of training to get. What to do with their money. As rational decision-making increases, some sort of power, at least over the course of your own life, increases, and that leads to a whole lot of positive benefits. So I think critical thinking is critical. One aspect of critical thinking is don't believe things just because everyone else is. This seems obvious, but it wasn't so obvious to the ancient Romans. They had a phrase for it. In Latin, it's argumentum ad populum. Now, you might have heard of the wisdom of the crowds, but that's actually quite limited. It only works in some limited circumstances. So don't believe it just because everybody else is. Ask yourself if you believe it's true and look at the evidence yourself. We're living in an age where information is easily mistaken. Well, misinformation is easily mistaken for information. Pseudo-facts can look a lot like facts, especially on the Internet. Each of us has to take responsibility for sorting this through ourselves. As Tolstoy said, a wrong doesn't cease to be wrong just because the majority share in it. I mean, look at slavery, genocide. A whole bunch of people believe in it, doesn't make it right. Or I think even St. Augustine said it better. Right is right even if no one is doing it. Wrong is wrong even if everyone is doing it. It's up to us to make up our own minds. Don't believe something just because there's a fancy website behind it. Don't reject a source just because it's occasionally wrong. New York Times makes mistakes. Every day they have to print retractions and corrections. But still, for my money, they are the most likely. They're among a small group of news outlets that's the most likely to be accurate. Include the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, NPR. Of course, reporters and papers have their biases, but they try very hard to show both sides of an argument. Especially in the New York Times science reporting, you'll notice, and that's the one I watch the most closely as a scientist, but you'll notice whenever they report on a science finding, they go out of their way to find somebody who thinks it's malarkey, and who gives the other side. And they try to do that with their political reporting and their international news reporting. If it's Syria or if it's Crimea, they try to get people who are on both sides so that you can make up your own mind. And I think that's the way it should be. Correlation doesn't equal causation. Just because two things happen together doesn't mean that one caused the other. Ice cream sales have gone up in Washington, D.C. in the last week. So has the number of people wearing short pants. I don't think one caused the other. Clearly, there's some third factor that's driving both. But, the correlation could lead you to believe that one's causing the other. You'd be wrong. And in some cases, it's not even a third factor like increasing temperatures. The stock market peaked earlier this summer, and the day that it reached its peak is the day I happened to see a whale in the Pacific Ocean. But I don't think that the whale was, jubilant because the stock market went up, or that the stock market went up because it's sensitive to the whale. I mean, there are coincidences in the world. Getting back to the Twain quote that I opened up with, it ain't what you know that gets you into trouble, it's what you know for sure that ain't so. I have some news for you. Twain didn't say it. I read it in the movie on a big screen in The Big Short. And I also saw it in Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth. It was there, the exact wording I gave to you and attributed to Mark Twain. But before I published this book, I knew that people would be fact-checking me, and I felt some responsibility to find it. And there, it's nowhere in anything that Twain wrote. But so why do we believe that Twain said it? Well, it's got the word ain't in it. This phrase, just ain't so. It really sounds like something Twain would say. But no, Twain. Not only did Twain never say it, nobody ever said it. There's no evidence that any, Will Rogers didn't say it. Bret Hart didn't say it. I mean, Al Gore said it, right. So it's not that it matters so much to the state of the world that these people got the quote wrong, but isn't it ironic that they were so sure that it was so, so sure that Twain said it, that they ran with it without checking the facts? And that's what, in a movie, it may not matter so much, but in medical decision-making or political decision-making, it really does matter if you have the facts right. As it's been said, you know, you're entitled to your own opinion. You ain't entitled to your own facts. So here's a case where I think you don't always know what you think you do, and I think that humility plays a big role in all of this. I think the bedrock of critical thinking is to be humble and realize you don't know everything. There are some experts who know more things than you. If you're not humble, then you can't learn anything. If you are humble, then the entire world is your classroom and everybody in it is your teacher. And I think that's not a bad way to be. I'm happy to take questions. Thank you very much. Or no questions.
Well, one.
Ah.
Well, I wouldn't mind being one of your students in Berkeley. That was great. For
Come
your
join
first...
us.
Yeah, just a little walk. I read the Washington Post every day, and especially today's issue, there's a big a poll result kind of thing. And personally, I wonder, I'm always getting phone calls that are anonymous. They don't have a name on it. They just have a phone number. And occasionally, I'm pretty sure that they're a pollster. But I really don't like answering anonymous phone calls, so I don't answer them. So this, right away, skews.
Absolutely.
And I'm just wondering how pollsters correct for this.
Well, so they try to do... A good pollster will use a variety of means to get to people. They'll use the phone. They'll stop people in the street, you know, in front of Whole Foods or whatever. They'll send emails. They try to get a cross-section. And if they're doing their job, they'll ask you something about your background. Where do you live? How old are you? What's your educational level? So they can be sure that they're sampling people from all different walks of life and all different experiences. And if they find that they haven't, then they keep collecting data until they do have something that represents the country. But it's, as you point out, it's very, very hard to do. I don't answer polls. I don't take surveys. So, and there are a lot of people like me that don't. I think the worst – I'm not a political scientist, and so I'm loath to step outside my area of expertise. But I think the worst thing that polls do is they potentially keep people home on election day because people think that the outcome is a foregone conclusion. And that's not a good way for a democracy to function. Ah, we got two sides to every story. Yes.
The left and the right.
Yes. On the right.
Correct. How did Marshall McLuhan affect your career?
Oh, I don't know that he did.
Particularly as Roman Catholicism.
Help me out here.
He was in vogue, wrote a lot of successful books.
Yes, he did.
Then he lost touch, but now he's back.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
And what is it about the story that attracts you to it?
Canada. See, McGill University is one of the great schools of the world, and he taught at the University of Toronto.
Yes, he did.
And Canadians have their own perception of America. And the United States watches TV, and the world watches America. And he was part of that.
Yes. So I know McLuhan as a great Canadian. I'm an American. I've been teaching at McGill University for 16 years. It's a privilege to teach there, and it's an interesting thing to live in Canada and see America from there. I also spend part of the year in California, so I'm getting two very different views of the country. I know Marshall McLuhan for his famous insight that the medium is the message, and his film and television work. And as I say, he's a respected Canadian scholar, but I haven't studied him. I'm not really a media studies person. I'm a simple country neuroscientist. But I'm going to look into it more. I'm glad you brought him up.
I think you're brothers.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Hi, thank you. That was really wonderful. Do you have any recommendations for training or especially early education to help children or young people from a pretty early age sort of learn some of the skills you're describing?
I absolutely do.
And I also particularly am interested in what you think about the Socratic method. And I know in my own life, going through law school and being put through those paces was, you know, extremely valuable in helping me acquire the skills that you're talking about.
Well, let's use the Socratic method. What do you think we should be doing with with kids?
So I'm, you know, based on the fact that, how revelatory I thought that method was, some version of that.
I think so, too. So, you know, I have a couple of things to say about this, and thank you so much for bringing this up. First, lectures are a really great way to teach. They're great from in elementary school and intermediate school and high school and colleges and graduate programs. They're a great way to teach. They're a terrible way to learn. And what do I mean by that? It's really convenient for administrators and teachers to be able to stand in front of a large classroom and just talk. Nobody has to really think very much. But the Socratic method is difficult, and it doesn't scale well to a large class. The classes that I teach that are most effective have 15 students, and I don't do very much talking. If I was ever in a classroom where I talked as much as I am right now, I would have failed my students. The students present information. I question them. I ask them to follow up. I sort of act more like a referee or a basketball coach. That's the best way of training, and I think we should start doing that in elementary school. And I think that every 12-year-old, if not younger, should be taught, as soon as you get to a website, that's not the end of the research enterprise. That's only the beginning. Ask yourself, who operates the website? Might there be biases in the way that they've ordered and structured the information? Is it a shill organization? If I'm looking for something on the nutritional value of almonds, and the website is called AmericansForBetterNutrition.com, is it really the Almond Growers Association of America with a funny website name? That happens. I talk in here about a case in Florida where there was a congressional race, and one of the contenders opened up a website in his opponent's name in order to collect money meant for her and raised a whole bunch of money. You know, it was support, you know, alexsink.com is the name of the website. And he collected all the money. And he wasn't Alex Sink. He was the competitor. So I think, you know, starting at 12, if not younger, we need to teach students to be critical thinkers. And I was gratified to learn that a bunch of high schools have adopted this book as a textbook, as have a bunch of universities. And I'm just hoping that, you know, people – it doesn't have to be my book. I mean, there are a lot of good books on critical thinking, but – you know, this one is the newest one, so there's contemporary examples, and I like to think it's written in a simple way, not simplistic, but a simple way that anybody can follow. And, I mean, the big thing is that a revolution has happened in the last 15 years that not a lot of people have talked about, and that is that information has become instantaneous and free. And what does that mean for education? We used to spend all our time in the classroom trying to cram facts into people's heads, like photosynthesis is the process by which plants turn oxygen into carbon dioxide into oxygen, and the sun is 93 million miles away, and the moon is a quarter of a million miles away, and in 1892, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and the primary colors are red, yellow, and blue. I mean, all these facts. Now, as the New Yorker columnist Adam Gopnik says, by the time a teacher has explained the difference between elegy and eulogy, everybody in the class has already Googled it. So it can't be that education is about teaching facts anymore. The students are going to get them. It has to be teaching them how to evaluate the information they encounter and to use it wisely. Thank you so much for that question.
You mentioned that one helpful thing in evaluating media is to see whether or not when certain facts are presented, the media outlet does its best to bring in opposing facts. And that sounds sensible to me. But sometimes when I watch some of the news outlets that I like the best and that I trust the most, I find a bending over backwards to make the two things that they're comparing the same. And I wonder if you notice that distortion in the media. In other words, especially in the presidential campaign, I find a lot of comparisons. You have information presented, and then they go way out of their way to find something comparable to stand up against it. And as an intelligent person, I look at the two things and I say, I understand you're trying to be fair, but I think you're engaging in a kind of distortion yourself by suggesting to me that these two things are equal.
I agree with you. And this is a problem in scientific research as well, where in a published article, there are hierarchies of believability and hierarchies of information sources, and sometimes scientists will really pick a non-rigorous and not valid source in order to give the patina of neutrality to their claim. And I think that's a distortion, too. I agree with you. We have to see through that, and we have to see that, yeah, they mentioned this other side, but that there really isn't anything behind that claim.
Right. So it's really a disservice to the viewer,
it is.
I think, to take fairness to that.
I agree story. With you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for your presentation. I have a question and then maybe a comment about another example of polling bias. One, you were talking about the political polling, et cetera, and I think Chris Matthews was supposed to be here tonight. I don't know.
By the way, he's a friend of mine. He sends his regrets. He
okay.
got called away literally at the last minute for a late-breaking story in New York. He didn't tell me what the story was, but he was sorry that he didn't join us here, but
well, it's probably the 8 o'clock forum that's going on with Trump and Hillary. Yeah, but speaking of the polling of the election, one other phenomenon they're talking about is not just who are you polling, whether it's by the phone or internet, et cetera, but there's a participation bias in the sense that some may not even want to say who they're voting for.
Oh,
they're
absolutely.
Counted as undecided. So that's why some say, well, you know, Hillary may be ahead, but really there are a lot of Trump voters out there who are embarrassed to say they support Trump. And therefore, I don't know how you can even measure what that margin of error could be, whether you ask the undecided, hey, are you really undecided? But you're not telling us, whether that would get yet a further information or not. And then the second example I have of when I see I'm a lawyer, too, by the way.
We need more of those.
Yes, right.
Especially exactly. In Washington.
Let's kill all the lawyers, Shakespeare said. For example, in the criminal justice, the general poll is that 60% of the people are in favor of the death penalty, 40% are against it. And those who are against the death penalty say, well, if you ask the public, hey, if we had life without parole as an option, would you be in favor of that? And then the number goes down to maybe 50% favor of the death penalty. They say, see, we should go to that. But the real question is, should the jury have the option of deciding, for example, whether Timothy McVeigh should get the death penalty or the white supremacists who dragged the African-American by the chain on the pickup truck in Texas and killed him? Should he get the death penalty? He did. And therefore, if you ask it that way, you might get more like 70-80% saying, yes, the jury should have the option.
Right. You're absolutely right, and I discussed this in the book, that the way you ask the question can profoundly influence the answers you get. And that's why you want to know what the pollsters asked, so you can evaluate for yourself whether you think that they rigged the deck in the very asking of the question. And if that's not reported to you, you got nothing to go on.
Hey, thanks for your presentation.
Oh, thank you.
I have one question that I was curious about. So as it relates to critical thinking, this group, you're preaching to the choir. But there's I think your intellectual evil twin out there that wants to suppress critical thinking because it empowers them or their political movements. Do you think there's any hope for scientists like yourself to be able to blunt that movement, to encourage people to think critically who have been taught perhaps that critical thinking is not a virtue?
I think the hope is that, there are a bunch of people who don't engage in critical thinking and don't appear to care about evidence and are not evidence-based thinkers. And I think part of it is that people say, oh, well, I don't want to be a Mr. Spock-like automaton and just be rational all the time. And I'm not saying you have to be rational all the time. You can still have room for serendipity and joy and passion in your life. I'm saying for decisions that matter evidence-based decision-making is going to have a better outcome most of the time. And I think all of us, as parents and grandparents, teachers, children, sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, we have to impress upon others that there's a value in being rational.
But there's a dividing line. So I think in 2012 we learned that, and this may not have been true, but it seemed to have been the case, that the Texas Republican Committee, among their planks, said we want to suppress critical thinking in our young students because that critical thinking forces too many questions on authority figures. So we're going to try and tamp that down. So if you've got a generation of kids, perhaps, that have been trained to not think critically, can you get past that barrier that's been established very early and help them? Or are they a lost generation that will perpetuate following authority figures that may
it's
like
a,
them
It's
be?
A great point. You know, I've devoted my life to education, so I think that education matters. And I think that if you give a person an opportunity to learn something, they're going to want to learn it. I think we're just built that way. But if you shut down the opportunities, that's what leads to the disasters we're seeing. And I think, you know, teaching requires some patience and some nurturing and some support. And all of us have it in us to do that. We have to find it sometimes. And I think the other thing is that The biggest piece of persuasive power we have, the biggest carrot and stick we have, is telling people who don't want to engage in critical thinking that lack can lead to a shorter life and more illness and less life satisfaction. Hit them where they live. One more. The young man here in the vest.
Thank you very much for your lecture. That's a joke. when you say what the majority thinks is not necessarily correct, doesn't that pose a problem for adhering to democracy as a system of government? And if so, what do you suggest to do about it?
Well, I'm not a political scientist. I'm outside my area of expertise here. But I think democracy, in theory, and when it's working, is a self-correcting process. So the majority believed in slavery at one point. We got rid of that. And even for 100 years after the abolition of slavery, there was terrible racism. And through Lyndon Johnson and other programs, we were able to begin the process of getting rid of racism. We haven't succeeded, as recent events have shown us. I'm sure there are other ways in which the majority of people believe things that are not optimal. But we're working on it. And that's what the democracy gives us, is people have an opportunity to share their views. And as long as everybody's open-minded enough to listen even to people they disagree with, we can hopefully move forward. Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.